Today's Dhamma talk will be about some further qualities that we need to possess in our meditation practice, and also about obstacles in the practice, and it's good to know what these obstacles are and ways to overcome them. Now, first of all, as an introduction, a verse from the Samyutta Nikaya, the Connected Discourses of the Buddha, where he says, he or she who is possessed of constant virtue has understanding or wisdom and is concentrated, is strenuous and diligent as well, will cross the flood so difficult to cross. In other words, will cross over to the other shore. So in order to achieve this, in order to realize Nibbana, certain things need to be there. And the very first factor mentioned is what? Virtue. And not just virtue, but constant virtue. So what we need is not an on and off morality or observing an ethical code, but rather we need to do this in a constant manner, in a continuous manner, at least as long as we are on retreat. And if possible, of course, to do the same thing after a retreat. And this practice or training in virtue then is to be complemented by wisdom. Now, the way it unfolds is that, first of all, we have to concentrate the mind. And only when the mind is somewhat concentrated does wisdom arise. So please do not mistake this verse to mean that first wisdom comes and then concentration. Concentration comes first, followed by wisdom. Now, there are other qualities that a meditator needs to possess in order to cross over. And among these is strenuous effort or ardent effort. In the Pali language, known as ātapa. And this means that with ardent effort, we burn and bring to exhaustion the mental defilements that are causing so much trouble. And apart from exerting effort, we also need to be very diligent in the meditation practice. So it follows from this that practicing in a superficial manner will not do the job. So it's just like in the outside world, when you have a well-paying job, you have to be focused and you have to be diligent in your work in order to succeed. And when these qualities are present and fully developed in a meditator, then it certainly becomes possible to cross over to the other shore. Now, in this whole process of meditation, obstacles are to be expected. And the Buddha, in a different discourse mentioned in the gradual discourses of the Buddha, namely the Anguttara Nikaya, speaks of six obstacles. And as an introduction to this, he says, without giving up six things, O monastics or O meditators, will it not be possible to abide contemplating the body as a body? Will it not be possible to contemplate feelings as feelings? Will it not be possible to contemplate the mind as mind? And will it not be possible to contemplate Dhamma objects as Dhamma objects? And What this refers to is that if we don't overcome these six obstacles, then we won't be able to carry out the four foundations or the four establishments of mindfulness, the so-called Chattaro Satipatthana in the Pali scriptural language. Now, what are these six obstacles? The very first one is given as follows, namely, to be fond of activity. The second one is given as to be fond of talking. The third one is mentioned as to be fond of sleeping. Then the fourth one as to be fond of company. And number five is lack of sense control. And number six is immoderate eating. Now, these six obstacles will be explained one by one. To be fond of activity means while one is on an intensive meditation retreat, one does things that are not necessarily in line with the intensive meditation practice. And in the past, when I stayed at the Banditaram Meditation Center in Burma for many years, and this being an international meditation center, well, all sorts of meditators have gone through there. Meditators from all over the world. So you get to see all sorts of behavior. And in one case, without revealing the nationality of the person, it was a monk. This particular monk was very much fond of activity. So even though he was supposed to practice intensively under the guidance of the Venerable Sadhu Pandita, he felt it was more important to make good use of the orange peels that were left over after the meals, knowing that orange peels can be dried and then can be ground up and can be turned into marmalade. So he was thinking that he was rendering the community a great service by producing marmalade. Now, this is a wonderful activity which could be done outside of a retreat, which should be done outside of a retreat and not necessarily during a retreat. Now, then at some other time, we had another monastic, foreign monastic, who was skilled in acupuncture. So he was practicing intensively from 3 o'clock in the morning. Wake up time there is in Burma is not 4 o'clock like here, but 3 o'clock. And so from 3 o'clock in the morning until after lunch, he would be practicing very intensively. Once he had finished his lunch, he would go back to his room, open up the doors of his room, and declare it an acupuncture clinic. Again, out of much compassion for all the suffering beings in the monastery, he would then give acupuncture treatment to whoever needed it. Now, of course, this was well received by those in search of some treatment. However, he did not help this foreign monastic in his meditation practice. And the whole story, unfortunately, took a very bad and unpredicted turn. Namely, this particular monastic, maybe because he used those same acupuncture needles on himself, but it's not absolutely sure, well, he ended up with hepatitis B and had to go back to his home country, and eventually he did pass away 2 years later. Now, I'll give you one more example, and again, it's the first monk, the one who was so fond of producing marmalade on retreat. Well, he was very very creative, and occasionally he could be seen in the midst of a meditation or in the midst of a sitting meditation, sitting in the last row, going through his photo album. I hope that none of you have brought the photo album along to relish in past memories. Again, this is an activity which is totally out of place. We're here for intensive meditation practice, and we're not here to distract ourselves. And so, keep in mind know what is important, what is related to the meditation practice. Do this, and refrain from any kind of activity that is not absolutely necessary. I'll give you one more example, maybe more common, namely. Some people are very much into hatha yoga, and they don't want to lose their form, and so they feel compelled to do extensive hatha yoga exercises on retreat, like 2 hours in a row. Now, this too would be out of place, and if you could limit your exercising to 20 minutes or 30 minutes in the room, then this would be quite enough, and try to do it as mindfully as possible. Now, the second obstacle to intensive practice, to the development of mindfulness, to the development of concentration and wisdom, is that of talking. Now, even though the retreat has been announced as a retreat in silence, yet some people might think that it's necessary to talk to one's neighbor. And this is not recommended. It's not recommended because it will interfere with your meditation practice. And as mentioned already during the previous Dhamma talk, talking is considered a major hindrance to progress in one's meditation practice. And the reason for this is very simple. If you talk for 5 minutes with somebody else, and then you will disrupt your own practice for at least 5 minutes, and you will also disrupt another person's practice for 5 minutes. But usually it doesn't stop with this. And after a conversation, let's say you remember to be mindful again, and then you go back to sitting meditation, you sit with eyes closed, you try to observe your rising and falling, and very soon the conversation comes and pops up in your mind. And you remember what you said, you remember what the other person said, and you realize, ha, I could have said this, I could have said another thing, and the whole thing. And the conversation continues on a mental level. So, talking indeed is a great distraction, and therefore it should certainly be limited to an absolute minimum. And then there is another major obstacle to this mindfulness practice, namely in the form of being fond of sleeping. Now, in the field of Vipassana meditation, the usual guideline is to limit one's sleeping hours to about 4 to 6 hours. And so the Venerable Mahasisada says 6 hours are clearly enough from a health point of view. Anything beyond that is in excess. Now, at home, you might be used to sleeping many hours. Some people are very much fond of sleeping. They sleep like 8 to 10 hours a night. And so, this may be necessary. I can't judge this. But on retreat, usually meditators find that since they're mindful, more or less mindful, throughout the day, there are less unwholesome mental states arising in the mind, and thus it's less tiring for the mind, less exhausting, and thus one gets by with less sleep. Advanced meditators usually find that when they experience the knowledge of equanimity about certain formations in the Pali language. This is known as Sankhopeka Jnana, that they get by with very little sleep. And some meditators sleep only 3 hours in a 24-hour period, some even only 2.5 hours or 2 hours. And we've had meditators in Lumbini complaining that sleeping, even sleeping for 1.5 hours was certainly interrupted, and so the meditator even had to make an effort to fall asleep to get some sleep in. So sleep is a very relative thing, and so our sleep pattern on retreat will definitely change. It will be definitely different from ordinary sleep patterns at home. And keep in mind that this meditation practice is absolutely about developing alertness, developing awakeness and wakefulness, and not the opposite. So being on retreat here is not about developing the ability to sleep during Dhamma talks, or to sleep or during daydream during the sitting sessions. So try to make best use of your time. And so we need to, apart from an alert and wakeful mind, we need to develop the mind so that it becomes really sharp and clear. And this is possible only if you try to dispel the sleepiness again and again. Now, the fourth obstacle to the development of the four establishments of mindfulness is given as certain being fond of company. Now, the usual idea or the principle that underlies the meditation practice is that we practice together, yet we are alone. We are all by ourselves. So being, being alone together with others. And a meditation retreat is definitely not a place to socialize. If you want to socialize, then you have to do this outside, or you'd be advised to do this outside of a retreat or after the retreat. And in this connection, too, a small anecdote from Burma at the same meditation center, the Panditarama Meditation Center in Yangon, Burma. For a few years, there was a group of monastics from one particular country, and they had adopted the practice of the behavior. Every day after lunch, they would meet in one of the monastics' place and then get together there. They'd get together, share a cup of tea, and have some small talk. And after that, they would disperse and go back to intensive practice. Now, this definitely did interfere with their practice, and it did slow down their their development of wisdom. And so it took them much longer than it would have taken somebody else, or would have taken the same person, without all this getting together and sharing and so on. And then we feel obliged to talk, we feel obliged to worry about the other person, we might think that we have to give advice to the other person, and so on and so forth. So there's a need for exchange, and this is not necessary on retreat. And so with the daily Dhamma talks, you get to hear the important points for your theoretical as well as practical points for your meditation practice, and so the daily interviews also help a lot to clarify what is not clear. Now, if you really need company, then there is only one companion that that you should seek. And which companion is this? Who knows?
Your teacher.
Your teacher? Yeah. Anything else?
Pardon me?
What's that?
Ourselves.
Ourselves? And apart from ourselves? Nama? Gaya?
Buddha.
The Buddha. You're getting close. The Dhamma. So take the Dhamma as your companion. And if you take the Dhamma as your companion, then you will see that this Dhamma will not disappoint you. And it will not fail to give you encouragement. It will not fail to show you the right direction. So if really you need a companion, then please take the Dhamma as your companion. And so there's no divorce there, and no other difficulties. And so then as for the fifth obstacle mentioned in the Anguttara Nikaya, this is given as a lack of sense restraint. Now, already yesterday in the evening, as part of the basic meditation instructions, mention was made of the need to restrain one's senses, to restrain one's eyes, one's ears, one's nose, the tongue, and the body, as well as the mind door. And this is extremely important for progress in one's meditation. Now, restraint of the senses is known in the Pali language as Indriya Samvara Sila. So you hear of the term Sila there, namely morality. Morality consisting in the restraint of the senses. Indriya are the senses, and Samvara is restraint. So this Indriya Samvara Sila is one form of morality. The observance of the precepts is another form, and then we have morality consisting in a proper livelihood, and finally we have, let me see what else. So anyway, this restraint of the senses brings the following benefits. When it restrains one's certain senses, then it prevents the mind from being disturbed by external objects with which one comes in contact through the senses. And I'll give you an example for this. While you're doing the walking meditation with senses unrestrained, so you're looking around, then your eyes might fall on some beautiful young woman or some handsome young man. And just the sight of this object may be enough to destabilize the mind and to bring about unwholesome mental states. And based on what one has seen, a certain feeling might arise, and then a pleasant feeling, and then craving might follow, and it might even lead to clinging. So, in a mind that previously was pure, now we have some unwholesome mental states arising. And the opposite case would be that of a meditator who restrains his or her senses, and even though there is some handsome young man walking by or some beautiful young woman walking by, it doesn't matter. One doesn't even see the person. As a result of this, there's no pleasant feeling arising, and no craving and nor clinging arising in the mind. Furthermore, with the absence of mental defilements, or the inability of mental defilements to arise, so through restraint of the senses, a certain freedom from mental defilements, temporary freedom from mental defilements, is there. And so this in turn will give rise to the arising, or will give rise to ease or happiness, sukha in the Pali scriptural language. And based on this sense of ease or happiness, it is quite likely then for concentration to arise, since it is said that the proximate cause for the arising of concentration lies in happiness or ease. When the mind is at ease or one feels happy, then it is easy to concentrate. On the other hand, if the mind is agitated through worries or through displeasure or whatever else, then it's very difficult to become concentrated. So with this we can say that this restraint of the senses very much helps a meditator not only to bring about certain ease or happiness, but also to bring about concentration. And we can take the whole thing one step further by saying that the concentration in turn will lead to the arising of more and more wisdom or understanding. So a meditator understands the nature of a predominant object. He said in the context of this restraint of the senses that whenever this restraint of the senses, Indriya Samvara Sila, is present and it is coupled with mindfulness, sati, it is coupled with wisdom or insight, knowledge, jnana, and further, kanti, patience is present, and effort is also present. Under these circumstances, with this constellation, particular constellation, well, one or the other of these so-called eight wholesome classes of consciousness are bound to arise in the stream of consciousness. However, in the opposite case, when there is a lack of restraint of the senses, and instead of being mindful, one is forgetful, and this in Pali is known as mutta saccha, and instead of having insight, anjana is there, namely a lack of insight knowledge, and instead of patience, impatience is there, and instead of effort, laziness is there, or indolence is there, then you can imagine what happens. Namely, the 12 classes of, or 12 types of unwholesome consciousness will arise in the stream of consciousness. And so, simple things such as restraint or lack of restraint of the senses has different consequences. In one case, the consequences are contributing towards the further development of one's practice. In the other case, the consequences are of a negative nature. Now, the last obstacle mentioned in the Anguttara Nikaya is that of immoderate eating. And human beings frequently have a tendency to eat either too much or not sufficient at all. And on the retreat, one learns to take just the right amount of food. And the way this happens is that usually in the beginning of a retreat, since everything is so difficult and it's quite strenuous to do the practice, one feels like eating more than usual. And eating itself may become a form of making up for all the suffering in the practice. So it's kind of like an escape, wanting to get away from the practice through eating. Now, when one falls into this pitfall, then one will realize very soon during the next sitting meditation that much drowsiness arises. And so there's a lot of nodding. And the nodding drowsiness may last for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, or even 15 minutes. And this does not seem like the right thing. This doesn't seem like right practice. So sooner or later, a meditator will make the connection and see that too much eating leads to drowsiness. And then the next day, during breakfast and during lunch, this meditator then will voluntarily cut down on the food. And eventually, and with this, then have maybe better results in the sitting meditation. And so gradually one learns to find just the right balance, to take enough food so that one can sustain this body, so that one has enough strength to do the practice, and not too much food so that one doesn't fall asleep. So much for the six obstacles. If you manage to avoid or to overcome these six obstacles, then this is already a major success in your practice. Now, apart from these six obstacles, there are other things to keep an eye on. And one important point is that of observing the presently arising objects. So what this means is to keep one's mind as much as possible in the present moment. As human beings, we may think outside of a retreat that we're quite attentive to the present moment, when in fact we're not. And the usual experience is that the mind wanders either into the past or into the future, and we're barely ever in the present moment. And it takes a lot of practice to be really attentive to the present moment. Now, with regard to this, the Buddha has mentioned the following verse, which I would like to quote from Majjhima Nikaya, Sutta 1.3.1, and it's verse 3. Let not a person revive the past, or on the future build his or her hopes. For the past has been left behind, and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let him or her see each presently arisen state. Let him or her know that and be sure of it. invincibly, unshakably. Today, the effort must be made. Tomorrow, death may come. Who knows? No bargain with mortality. No bargain with mortality can keep him or her and his hordes away. But one who dwells thus ardently, relentlessly, by day, by night, it is he, the peaceful sage, has said, who has one fortunate attachment. So the emphasis here is clearly on not reviving the past and not building one's hopes on the future, and instead observing or seeing with insight each presently arising state. Now, as a further explanation for this, the objects of the past are uncertain in the sense that they've passed already. They are no more. All that we have of objects of the past is just a memory. And if we're mindful of the memory, then we're not mindful of the real thing. We're not mindful of what the event was like sometime in the past. And objects of the future, too, are uncertain. They're uncertain because they have not arisen yet. We can only imagine some object, some physical or mental object to arise in the future. But it's just an imagination. It's not necessarily a reality. So objects of the past are uncertain. Objects of the future are also uncertain for the Vipassana meditator. All a meditator has to work with are the presently arising objects. And thus we should keep this in mind, and we should try to come back to the present moment again and again. And it's quite common among the meditators to drift off or to get lost in wandering thoughts for 5 minutes or for 10 minutes, in some cases even for 20 minutes. And so this then is thinking meditation or remembering meditation, but not Vipassana meditation anymore. So try to bring your mind again and again back into the present moment. And this has to be done not only during the sitting meditation, but also during the walking meditation, and also during the general activities. Let's say you're taking a meal, and you're taking some food, and while you're chewing the new food, it may very well happen that your mind wanders off and is thinking about something something totally disconnected from the chewing of the food. Once you recognize this, immediately bring your mind back to the predominant activity, in this case the chewing of the food, and try to be aware of it. Maybe just as a footnote, a quick footnote, Vipassana meditation is different from psychoanalysis in the sense that it works with the present moment. Whereas in the case of psychoanalysis, the emphasis is on working with events from the past, oftentimes childhood events. And you can see from this that the approach is quite different in psychoanalysis than from the approach in Vipassana meditation. So in Vipassana meditation, the idea is to just work with what is now presently arising in the body and in the mind, and thus to see the wholesome as well as unwholesome mental states, and to see them, you know, see them for what they are, and then to transform whatever needs to be transformed. There's another factor that very much contributes to progress in one's meditation practice, contributes to strong development of one's practice. And this is the intensity with which one practices. Now, the late Venerable Mahasi Sayadaw very much emphasized this point. And so in his basic meditation instructions, he reminds meditators of someone who was trying in the very distant past, when the fire had to be ignited by rubbing two sticks or two stones against each other. Now, if one were to do this in an on and off manner, rubbing for a while and then taking a break to daydream and then rubbing again for a while, again stopping and thinking about something else, and then will a fire ever ignite? It will not. Likewise with the fire of insight. So if one stops, if one is rubbing the object of the predominant object of observation for a while, to then get lost in daydreaming, and then finally one wakes up from this daydreaming, rubs again a little bit, and then gets lost in thoughts again, in this manner the fire of insight will most likely not ignite so soon. And thus, please try to keep this intensity of your practice in mind, and try to do everything possible to intensify your practice. And there's different ways you can do this. So slowing down is one thing, continuity of mindfulness would be another thing, and then maybe doing the walking meditation along a wall would be another thing. Some meditators, while in sitting meditation, because they feel disturbed by the daylight, they even cover their eyes. Other ways of intensifying one's practice would be? You have any idea? No, you don't know? Oh, earplugs. Earplugs would be another one, yes. In Lumbini, we had one meditator who was extremely sensitive to external sounds, and took the whole thing to an extreme by using not only earplugs, but he even brought his headphones along. And so he was sitting in his room. This is maybe a little bit too much. Oh, another way to intensify one's practice is not to change one's certain posture too quickly. And then, of course, getting up early in the morning and practicing until late at night. And some people who've got lots of energy, lots of stamina, after lunch, instead of taking a nap, they manage to do some walking meditation. And so then after the walking meditation, they continue with sitting meditation. This is a wonderful way of maintaining one's continuity of practice. Then attitudes matter a lot. Attitudes with which we practice. And if the attitude is correct, then it's easy to do this practice. If the attitude is somewhat off, then we might end up facing plenty of difficulties. Now, some of these attitudes I mentioned already yesterday, such as competing with others, or setting oneself a certain deadline and certain things like these. Apart from these two, there is, or it's helpful to practice with an attitude of just letting the practice unfold by itself. So not to try to make the practice happen, not to interfere with the practice, not to manipulate or to control one's practice. Most people are very much in the habit of wanting to control their experiences. They want to have positive experiences, and so they'll do everything to have those experiences. They try to control the evolving of their lives. And when in fact the Buddha has spoken of the universal characteristic of anatta, of non-self, meaning that things are happening of their own accord. And this very much applies to the meditation practice. So what we can do is to be mindful from moment to moment, to make effort from moment to moment, and so on. And as for the results, well, that's another story. We'll just have to accept whatever comes along. Now, some meditators, when on a retreat, they look for the perfect retreat. They look for the perfect meditation teacher. They look for the perfect meditation center. Now, what do you think? Is there such a place, as a perfect meditation center or a perfect teacher? Huh? There is? Where? Here. Oh, good. Okay, well, I'm glad to hear. Well, it's pretty close to perfect. It is indeed. And well, when one is discontented in one's practice, then it easily happens that the mind goes off finding fault. And finding fault maybe with the setup here, or with the flies, or with the food, or whatever else it might be. Now, the mind is very creative. It can come up with all sorts of stories. And so in this kind of a situation, it's good to remember that perfection, or that it's very difficult to have perfect certain conditions, and simply to accept whatever is present, or whatever we have whatever we have here. And even if we were to attend a different retreat with a different teacher at a different retreat center, yet there'll be other difficulties there. So oftentimes it's an illusion to think that another place will be better. Meditators may find it difficult to adapt to a particular method of meditation, such as this method here, as recommended by the Venerable Mahasi Sayadaw, using the rising and falling movement of the abdomen as a primary object. So to some of you, this may be new or may be different from what you are used to. And at first, you might find it difficult. Yet, please do not despair, and just give this method a good try. Give it a couple of days, and then you will see that in the end it's worth it. And it does work, and there have been thousands and thousands, hundred thousands of people who've practiced in this way and who've had major success in the practice. Now, while having recognized wrongful attitudes, it's good to develop wholesome attitudes. wholesome attitudes such as accepting objects of observation as they are, so not looking for only the pleasant physical objects, some soothing chills and thrills, or looking for some pleasant mental states, but rather just observe whatever comes along. And to practice without any expectations whatsoever, not to set any deadlines, and to practice with a wholehearted and balanced effort. And what is recommended in the Visuddhimagga, the path of purification, under the heading of the nine factors of shape, sharpening the controlling faculties, namely to practice with care and respect. So every single moment counts, and every single moment, every single object bears the potential of leading a step closer to Nibbana or to enlightenment. And so we should practice with much care and respect, or to put it differently, to practice with devotion. And so when you practice like this, then you will see that things will unfold quite easily. Sometimes meditators come on a retreat, and when hearing a Dhamma talk, they might think, out of pride and conceit, oh, well, I've heard all of this already 10 times. This is nothing new, and they stop paying attention. So there's pride and conceit behind this, and one should be aware of it, and then be mindful of it, and let go of it. Such kind of an attitude might very much interfere with one's meditation, and with this, one is no longer open to what is happening in the practice, or what is being said during the interviews, or during the Dhamma talks. Keep in mind that the goal of the practice is the unfolding of wisdom, and this happens only with a purification of the mind. And pride and conceit is obviously an unwholesome and impure mental state. So it's best to let go of it as quickly as possible. And so, in whatever activity we might be undertaking, it's important to check one's objective with which one does this. And if the objective is somewhat off, one will not succeed. So applied to the meditation practice, this means when we practice, we should practice not with having minor objectives in mind, such as practicing for health improvement or to overcome stress and things like this, but rather we should aim for the ultimate goal, namely the attainment of path knowledge and fruition knowledge, which take Nibbana as an object. And so it is with path knowledge that suffering will be eradicated, at least to a certain extent. When we practice, there will be positive byproducts such as less stress and less tension, and so there will be some physical benefits to the practice, but these are of a secondary nature, and one should not get stuck with this. quality that also helps a lot is that of contentment. Namely, being contented with what one has, or contented with the status one is possessing, or the position. And so the Pali term for this contentment is santuti, and a similar term is that of apichatta, which means fewness of desires. And especially on a meditation retreat, if we possess this quality of contentment, being contented with few new things, then it's very easy to practice. But if we need many things, we need luxurious items and so on and so forth, many fancy things, then it gets difficult. And we may find that we have to spend more time looking after our possessions, and thus there is less time left for practice. Whoever possesses this quality of contentment will get by with very little, with few possessions, and will have many things to give away to others. So it very much contributes to the practice of generosity. And this quality of contentment also is a positive factor when it comes to morality, namely being contented. One doesn't need much, there will be very little craving or covetousness, and one will not be tempted to break any of the precepts, especially not the second one. So, in a passage that the Buddha has mentioned in several places in the text, a passage that talks about the gradual progress of a disciple, this contentment is given as one of, or as an essential quality. And the other qualities, the other things mentioned on this gradual path of, path of progress, is that of first hearing the Dhamma, then developing some initial faith, then the arising of thoughts of renunciation, then the voluntary observance of precepts, and then the practice of restraint of the senses, and then the practice of mindfulness and clear comprehension, sati and sampajanya, followed by the restraint of the senses, and then also contentment is mentioned. So it's one of those factors that are important for one's development as a spiritual disciple. Now, let me conclude today's Dhamma talk by wishing that may all of you be in a position to overcome the six obstacles mentioned, as well as a number of other pitfalls that may occur during the intensive practice, and also may you possess the various wholesome qualities mentioned, such as certain contentment, such as flexibility, happiness, and so on. And equipped with these qualities, may you progress swiftly in your meditation practice, and may the experience of the peace of Nibbana be yours, hopefully, during this retreat. Now, we'll do the metta chanting only today. Or questions? Oh, yeah, indeed. You want to ask some questions? Pain.
Physical pain.
What about pain? What's the problem with pain?
It's not fun.
not fun. Well, in the beginning, indeed, pain or the observation of a pain may not be fun, and you're quite right. You know, however, the whole thing is very, very much relative. So, what seems like quite dramatic and quite difficult in the beginning of one's meditation, later on, it takes on a very different quality. And you will find that with your meditation practice, that at first you, have to struggle much to work with the pain or pains in general, and there's a lot of aversion arising towards the pain, and disliking, you want to get rid of the pain, you hate the pain, and so on and so forth. And then, later on, you may find that as your meditation develops, that a pain takes on a new quality, namely, it becomes much more neutral. And at that point, it's just another sensation, just like one out of 100 different sensations. And so, at that point, the situation is already quite different. And so, then, if you continue with your practice, you'll get to a point where you're even looking for a pain, and a pain you may consider a pain as a pleasant pain. You know? And the reason for this is that early on, you notice that working with a pain helps very much to develop concentration, and this then helps for your practice. And then, as the pains subside, and there are hardly any pains left, and so occasionally the mind starts wandering again, and that at that point, you might be longing for the pains to come back. And some meditators, in this particular situation, they even assume the full lotus posture in order to cause some pains to arise so that they have some solid, clear-cut object to work with. So what you see from all of this is that a pain is a very relative object, you know, and our relationship to a pain in the course of the meditation practice will obviously change. What seems so dramatic and so terrible in the beginning, later on, is no big deal whatsoever. If you have no other questions, then let's do the metta chanting, which is printed, which is part of the printout. But before we start, let me say just a few words about the metta chanting. Namely, this certain form of metta chanting comes from the Patthisambhidha Magga, the so-called path of discrimination, which is an elementary, a very fundamental text on the meditation practice, and just the Patthisambhidha Magga is as important as the Visuddhi Magga, the path of purification, and as the title indicates already, it is about loving-kindness, metta. However, three other qualities are being mentioned twice in the text. And you'll see, namely, the quality of compassion, karuna, meaning wanting to relieve others from their suffering, and then sympathetic joy, mudita in the Pali scriptural language, which is wishing for or rejoicing in success or wealth or the property of others, and wishing that may their property not certainly diminish. And so, the fourth quality is that of upekkha. Upekkha is a Pali term which stands for equanimity or equipoise or balance of mind. So, you know, taking a balanced outlook, and this is mentioned in the words of Kammasaka, namely understanding that we're all the heirs of our past actions, and in the end, there's nothing that we can do. You know, we'll just have to reap the results of our past actions of either this life or preceding existences. Now, as for metta itself, loving kindness, it has the or metta is about wishing for the welfare of others, welfare and happiness of others, and the function of metta is to promote others or prefer their welfare, and it manifests in the mind, which means we experience it as the removal of ill will. Whenever a loving kindness arises in the stream of consciousness, then the ill will, the hatred, the discontentment, and so forth will have to leave. And very nice is the proximate cause for the arising of loving kindness, namely, which comes in the form of seeing other beings as lovable. Now, many of us have, or as human beings, have this attitude of seeing the negative aspects, the shortcomings, the drawbacks of others. And we find it very difficult to see their good or lovable aspects. So the Buddha is recommending that we see their, that we give focus to or emphasis to seeing their positive qualities. And if we develop this this particular quality, then we'll be able to see something good even in an enemy, in a person who is causing us much trouble. And in this sense, if we see only the wholesome qualities, the positive qualities of beings, where is there a possibility for ill will, for hatred to arise? If you look long enough, you will find something positive in a person. And in the worst case, your enemy might, because he or she is your enemy, he may have helped you to develop patience. So this in itself is something positive, and you can be grateful to the person for just for that. Now, the metta chanting is done in a very structured here in this case is done in a very structured manner. And so one starts by radiating loving kindness to oneself, and then taking oneself as a yardstick, just like oneself wants to be free from danger and enmity, wants to be free from mental suffering, wants to be free from physical suffering, and wants to take care of oneself happily, so too others will want to do the same. And then by groups of persons, one radiates loving kindness to one's to one's parents, teachers, friends, relatives, and so on and so forth. And later on, you'll see it goes by groups such as all beings, all breathing creatures, and so on. And then loving kindness will be radiated in a directional manner, namely to all beings in the eastern direction and so in the other directions. Okay, maybe this much as an introduction to the Metta chant. And it's Galya who will lead it.
Purati Maya Nudisaya Vacci maya nudisaya, uttaraya nudisaya, dakshinaya nudisaya, iti maya disaya, upari maya disaya, sabi sata, sabi fana, sabi buddha, sabi bhagavata, sabi atabhava, pariyapana, sabha itiyo, sabi purisa, sabi ariya, sabi anariya, sabi deva, sabi manusa, sabi vinipatika, ave rahontu, abhyabhajyantu, anigahontu, sukhiyatanam, parihantu. Dukkha mucchantu yata, mada sampatita, vigacchantu, kama sakha. Udam yava bhavagacha, ado yava avichita, samanta chakravayisu. Isata pata vichara, abhyabhaja niviracha, nidukacha nupadya. Udam yava bhavagacha, ado yava avichita, samanta chakravalisu. Yesata udakichara, abhyabhaja niviracha, nidukacha nupadya. Udam yava bhavagacha, ado yava avichita, samanta chakravalisu. Isata akasichara, abhyabhaja niviracha, nidukacha nupadya. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.